Thank you very much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and I'd like to tell you what I've learned in the last 4 or 5 years about the challenges that pregnant women have breathing just simple fresh air. I have no financial disclosures on this topic yet, but I'm really looking forward to getting several. So this was on the front of Time in December 2004, almost 10 years ago. And basically it's talking about air pollution, and it notes bad air days in Hong Kong and Bombay. And the two photos at the bottom, the one on the left is from Mumbai in 2013, and the one on the right is from Beijing, suggesting that, yes, there are bad air days. And the bad news that close to Beijing on January the 12th this year, the air was labeled crazy bad, not breaking bad, but crazy bad, with an air quality score of 755. This is significant because the air quality score goes from 0 to 500. Greater than 300 is hazardous. Greater than 500 shouldn't be discussed. It's 20 times or more the safe level. So this is clearly bad. And the response was that people in Beijing, this was actually a photo taken outside the amusement park on January 12th, indicating that people were actually prepared for these bad air days with the fashionable masks that you see there. And this raises the question, oh my goodness, how many times do we hear it in the States? It's horrible out there. Stay indoors. But is it safer indoors? And I submit, having a whole slew of photos from India, sub-Saharan Africa, Bangladesh, etc., maybe. And this was a photo I took recently of a little kid playing with a stove that was being used for cooking, raising some serious questions about what is going on in the household. And in December of 2012, The Lancet published an entire series on the global burden of disease. And in the last paper in this series, it was looking at risk factors for death in millions, comparing 1990 with 2010. And I think you can see that poor diet and inactivity remains number one, however you look at the data, and with an increase of the effect of poor diet and inactivity. This isn't a huge shock. We're talking about global death, so this includes resource-poor countries as well as in the U.S. Hypertension was number two, but number three, twice, no change, although there was a slight decrease in air pollution being a risk factor over that 20-year period. And the idea is that it is inside the house, now known as household air pollution, used to be called indoor air pollution, but now everybody calls it household air pollution because there are all sorts of confirmations in the household. And tobacco, alcohol, etc. were number four and five. So clearly, household air pollution is a problem. So what are the facts about household air pollution? First of all, almost half of the world's population lives in households that use biomass fuel for cooking and heating. Typically, The fuels are in poorly ventilated living space. There may not even be a separate kitchen. And this causes high levels of household air pollution, which includes small particles that get breathed in, inhaled into the lung, carbon monoxide and other pollutants. Somewhere between 4 and 5 million people die, at least in part, related to household air pollution. And sadly, there's a disproportionate burden for those people who spend time in the household, women and children. Okay, so what's in HAP? It's a nightmare. You can't go somewhere and say, okay, this is what somebody is going to burn. I'm going to measure what is being produced. Because they may go to one place one day, pick up different wood or dung or straw the next day. It varies a lot. Some people use kerosene. Some people use coal. The trouble with household air pollution is it is a complicated mix of particulate matter that is pretty much present from all types of fuels that are burned. There are two types of particles. The large ones that get trapped in the upper airways, and then those rotten little ones that go right into the lower airways and cause damage. So what do? They irritate the airways. They mess up that mechanism that we have in the lungs to get rid of gunk, the mucociliary clearance. They mess up the macrophages so they don't deal with these particles and get rid of them. And all of these result in systemic inflammation and oxidative stress, both of which are bad. So what happens to pregnant women? They wheeze. They may also already have some chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And this obviously is a bad thing in pregnancy. This can also cause bronchitis, pneumonia, and increasingly there are reports of cataract due to irritation of the ocular surfaces. The effects on the baby. The babies are born low birth weight. Maybe they're growth restricted. Maybe they're preterm. And there is an increased risk of the baby being born stillborn or dying in the first 7 days of life. And that's just the particulate matter. Carbon monoxide is produced by many of these pollutants. What does carbon monoxide do? Exactly what it does in the States. Causes carboxyhemoglobin, inadequate oxygen delivery. But the pregnant women and the babies get exposed to chronic levels over time. What are the consequences? Cardiovascular consequences, CNS complications as a result of hypoxemia. And what are the effects on the fetus? Low birth weight, perinatal mortality. Sulfur dioxide, that's no bargain. Some of that's coming from coal, causes bronchial reactivity. It really doesn't sound too good. What does that do? Same deal. Asthma, COPD, cardiovascular. And then there are a whole pile of volatile compounds, polyaromatic hydrocarbons. There are hundreds of these. These are carcinogens. They're bad. And they result in growth restriction, preterm birth, and birth defects. So any way you look at it, I hope I've convinced you that household air pollution is no bargain under any circumstance, particularly for men and women and their babies. So why is this so complicated? In the rural areas, as you can see from this slide, you don't only have to worry about what the woman is burning in her household. You've got to worry about what's going on in the next household that may be very close by that spills over. And then you've got the brick kiln kicking out a whole pile of pollution. So I think you can see it's a very, very complicated mixture. And honestly, that's what makes it difficult to really understand what exactly is causing the burden of mortality. In the urban areas, there are different challenges. There's a lot of smoking in the home, waste burning, plastic being used as fuel is becoming increasingly common. And then in the urban areas, there's a lot of trouble with industrial air pollution. So I think you can see, even when we talk about household air pollution, it's not just in the household, although most of the effects do come from the household. Okay, so if I've convinced you that household air pollution isn't good, then how bad is it? Shouldn't we be able to put a number on it? But we can't. Because many of the studies that have been done have been of poor quality, and therefore we don't have good data. Well, why are they of poor quality? How do you measure exposure? Not easy. Most people, including our group at this moment, use proxies, which is basically what type of fuel do you usually burn? And as we've just pointed out, there are many, many sources of household air pollution in addition to the cooking stove. What are the outcomes? What are the health effects? Not always measured that well. For example, when people talk about low birth weight, and you don't bother to measure the birth weight of the baby until they're a month old, a little bit late. So that's been a quality issue with some of the studies. And a lot of the studies have problems with confounding other reasons that people might have bad outcomes during pregnancy and for the baby as well, particularly as socioeconomic status, because guess what? Poorer people are using the fuels that they don't have to pay for, that they can just gather from the woods and the fields. Dr. Derman mentioned that he and I are part of the NICEHD Global Network study. And in this study, we have a large registry in five low and low middle income countries. Dr. Derman and I both work in India, so we're the two Indian dots. We followed 65,000 pregnant women and their babies through day 42 postpartum. In our global network, we have a lot of households, 81% overall, that use some form of polluting fuel, which is dung, wood, straw, kerosene, coal, etc., i.e. not clean fuels. In our studies, we go into the households and we ask what type of fuel they cook with. So we're not actually measuring the levels of these particles, carbon monoxide, etc., yet. That's the next step. But you can see how we classified the clean and the polluting fuels here. And we asked two questions because we wanted to put numbers on how bad household air pollution is. We asked, is it associated with low birth weight and is it associated with perinatal mortality? And we do indeed find that household air pollution does reduce birth weight. So there are more low birth weight babies. Not a huge increase in percentage, only 15% more. But this is adjusted for those other risk factors for low birth weight. The decrease in birth weight was also not huge. The absolute number, 42 grams, sounds tiny. But imagine you shift every baby 42 grams lighter, and they continue to breathe in all this gunk. Is it any wonder they're not having a great start to life? Interestingly, we didn't find smoking to be a risk factor for low birth weight. Why? Probably because of all this gunk totally overwhelming the household air pollution. Did we find an effect on perinatal mortality? Yes, these babies are dying. 47% increase adjusted for the usual risk factors. Again, daily smoking was not an additional risk factor. So if I've convinced you that household air pollution is bad, don't we need to do something about it? So this is the cool thing. At the moment, there is a huge focus on new technologies for improved cook stoves and fuels. You need the both. The question is, are they any better? Because nobody puts these through the Food and Drug Administration and say, that's a nice little cook stove and it meets all the usual safety criteria. People just make these things. And it was only about 1 year ago that the EPA set standards and provided testing facilities for some of the major manufacturers of cook stoves. Obviously, it would be great if we could switch people over to clean fuels, particularly gas, electricity, and solar energy, but they're expensive and difficult to deliver. And I don't know whether you've ever watched a pot boil, but never do that with solar power. You will be here next year. Also, of course, we can improve the household design. Good luck. How's that going to work? I think the challenge is here. How do we change behavior? How do we tell women and their families, this isn't very good for you and your baby, and probably not for the men in the household too. We want you to change your entire cooking pattern. I think we've got a huge challenge, and you certainly know about how difficult it is to change behavior. And we are starting to look at how to do that, but goodness, this is huge. Hillary Clinton has been a huge supporter of the United Nations Foundation Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves. They have a 100 by 20 goal, which basically means 100 million homes will happily adopt clean, efficient cook stoves by 2020. 100 million, and we have 3 billion people who are exposed to this. But it is a good start. Maybe. But which stoves will be accepted? How many of those stoves will go into the house and sit right next to the 3-stone fire and never be used? And how many will actually work? We desperately need to study this. This conference is about thinking locally. So next summer, when you're preparing to watch a Red Sox game, and you decide to go and cook a beautiful barbecue meal, locally, you can be exposed to barbecue air pollution. BAP! Thank you very much.
So Dr. Hibbard continues to bring her passion to the global network, and now I think it's being compounded with the United Nations, with Gates. This is a very, very hot topic. And if you think getting an injection of DEPO is difficult, imagine what it's like to go ahead and change the whole way in which we provide and cook food for families around the world. This is a very major challenge. So I'm now going to turn the podium over to Dr. Jonathan Spector. Many of you from Boston know Dr. Spector. And I guess I learned early on in my career that if you can do a simple thing that is going to affect millions of people in the way they think, that's probably the best way to go ahead and impact change. And Dr. Spector and his group have done just that, and in fact using our team in India as one of the sites. And you all know that I don't walk into an operating room without going through a checklist before we ever touch a patient. So, Jonathan, all yours.